This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating the season with Holiday Blend Coffee and Holiday Breakfast Blend Tea at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, live interviews with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Roz Babner with Oregon Community Warehouse.
Rhode Island approves medical cannabis.
Hugo Chavez speaks of the axis of good.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,180 official acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. Iraq Bodycount.org reports 31,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2006. I'm Doug Weedy.
And I'm Lori Hilliard. Portland Cop Watch is holding orientation and trainings this month for people interested in police accountability activism. Live in Studio 2 right now is Dan Handelman. Dan, thanks for being here.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
A lot of KBOO listeners already know about your work, but for those who don't, why don't you start by telling us about Cop Watch? What do you do? How long have you been around? And what are some of the biggest projects right now?
Portland Cop Watch has been around since 1992. And we educate the public on police accountability issues, and we try to focus on educating people about what their rights are when they're stopped by the police, how to safely observe police, and that is to say cop watching. And we publish a newsletter three times a year that shows how all the different kinds of things police have been involved in Portland and the surrounding areas.
So tell us about your training cycle throughout this month. What will people be learning?
Well, it's a three-part training, and we're asking people to sign up in advance for them. But the first one is next Monday, January 9. It's our orientation, and it gives you background on what Portland Cop Watch is and what, you know, the kind of work that we do and some of the acronyms that get used over and over again in Portland, the PJTTF, for instance, the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force, and the Independent Police Review Division, the IPR. We talk about these things a lot, so we sort of bring people up to speed what all these things mean. And then we have a Your Rights in the Police seminar where we have a lawyer come in to help people through what your rights are when you're stopped by the police. That you, like if you're walking, you don't have to have your ID on you. If you're driving, you do, that kind of thing.
Hmm. Again, for people who may not know, can you describe some of the most important issues that Portland is dealing with in terms of police accountability?
Well, some of the most serious cases of police possible misconduct that we see are the shootings. And over the last couple of years, we've seen several people shot who were unarmed, and that's caused quite an uproar, and there have been protests, and the peace and social justice community has joined with the people of color communities who are often the victims of these shootings to march in the streets and demand accountability. So that's one of the main things that you see, the most visible things.
So, Dan, as an activist yourself, you've been spied on illegally by the local police. You've been brought before federal officials as a result of your Iraq affinity group work with Voices in the Wilderness. What are your thoughts on the new revelations of federal wiretapping and illegal surveillance of activists?
Well, in a way, it's not surprising, but in a way, we should all be surprised and outraged. And every time we hear something like this, get ready to oppose it. And I think it would be very interesting to find out what kind of files they have. I think that the fact that they are called intelligence agents is sort of an overstatement, and often the material that you find in these files is completely wrong. So I'd be really happy to see what they've got in the Portland community. Just to finish up, we didn't talk about the third training, which is cop watching, how to cop watch or safely observe police behavior, often with a camcorder or a still camera, just to take pictures of what's going on to help people safely just behave however they're going to. Sometimes it's in a neighborhood, sometimes it's on a particular street corner, sometimes it's at a demonstration. And so the three workshops that we're offering on January 9, the following three Mondays, January 9, January 23, and January 30, we're skipping the 16th because it's Martin Luther King Day. And so if people want to get involved or sign up, they should give us a call at Portland Cop Watch at 503-236-3065 or visit our website.
So as part of the using the camcorders in the neighborhood, what kind of a response do they get from the police that they're recording?
Well, it's mixed. A lot of times, like, we try not to just show up in some neighborhood with a camcorder. We'll wait until somebody invites us in so that the people in the area know that we're not some part of some police task force or the media or something, that we're there sort of to protect their rights. But we also don't want to assume who's right or who's wrong. It's possible that the cop is arresting somebody who just killed someone, you know, so you don't want to jump in with a camcorder. A lot of times the cops don't like being videotaped, but sometimes they'll ask who you're with, and they'll say, you just tell them Cop Watch, and they go, Cop Watch, oh, okay. You know, so they sort of have this knowledge about what we're doing, and they understand that we're not anti-police, we're just anti-police brutality. So it can be a mixed reaction.
All right. So could you please tell listeners how they can sign up for the Cop Watch training cycle?
Yes, the email address for it is trainings@portlandcopwatch.org. You can also get to that email address through our website, www.portlandcopwatch.org. And our phone number, as I mentioned a second ago, is 503-236-3065. We also are asking for a $10 reservation to hold people's spaces because it takes a lot of work to put these on, and sometimes we have to print a lot of materials. Like your rights cards, and we have a little training manual and stuff like that. So in order to just cover the cost of the trainings, we're just asking for $10. But if people can't afford that, that's okay. Nobody will be turned away for lack of funds. We'll just we might end up having to close down intake if we have too many people, because we can only train so many people at once.
Right. There's also an event that's coming up Friday, January 13th. I wondered if you could talk about this event called the Gulf War 15 Years Later.
Yeah, well, Portland Cop Watch, I forgot to mention, is a project of Peace and Justice Works, which is a group that's also been around since 1992. And our other main group is the Iraq Affinity Group. And next Friday, January 13, we're co-sponsoring the weekly Friday rally with Portland Peace for Response Coalition. It's basically January 16th will be exactly 15 years since the bombs started dropping on Iraq under Bush the First. And we see the war that's going on now as a continuation of that war. So this is a day to commemorate that, the beginning of that part of the war, and everything that's happened since then, and tie it together and call for an end to the fighting that's going on now.
Okay. Well, that was Dan Handelman of the Portland Cop Watch. Thanks so much, Dan, for being with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just so for people to know that the training will be taking place on the Community Language and Culture Bank office at Northeast Graham and Martin Luther King Boulevard on the 2nd, 4th, and 5th Mondays of January.
Thank you so much. And to reiterate, the Gulf War 15 years later, that will be held Friday, January 13th from 6 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square at Southwest Broadway and Yamhill in Portland.
Agencies that distribute energy assistance dollars say that near-record natural gas and oil prices have caused more people to seek help earlier in the cold season, causing many organizations to run out of funds. Even though an estimated 413,000 Oregonians qualify, only 20% of eligible households have received financial energy assistance this winter. Usually, the request for assistance comes from renters, but this year, homeowners are also applying, stretching resources thin. With winter not quite 2 weeks old, agencies are already prioritizing money for people who have received a 5-day or 72-hour shutoff notice. Susan Stoltenberg, Executive Director of Portland Impact, says that people are making choices between food and heat.
24 out of 25 Oregon beaches looking good after recent downpour, are looking good after a recent downpour, but only Agate Beach waters are temporarily off limits. KBOO's Ross Egan reports.
An Oregon public health advisory was issued December 30th due to a higher than normal level of bacteria in ocean waters at Agate Beach, just north of Newport. After the recent rains of the 25 Oregon beaches regularly monitored by the Oregon Beach Monitoring Program, only Agate Beach had high enough bacteria levels to warrant an advisory. Newport City water treatment personnel indicated that the city has separate sewage and runoff systems in place to help prevent untreated waters from being released. And Jennifer Ketterman of the Oregon Department of Human Services indicated that the high bacteria count might have been due to the water sample being taken at high tide, which picked up bacteria from debris on the beach. A representative of Oregon Parks and Recreation indicated that animal waste, septic sewage overflow, and a possible overflow at a water storage facility might have contributed to the health advisory. For KBOO News, Ross Egan.
Oregon Community Warehouse is a nonprofit agency in Portland that provides furniture and household items to people in need at no cost. The group is in the middle of a major campaign. Live with us in Studio 2 is Roz Babner. Roz, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about the Oregon Community Warehouse. When did you open and how did you get started in this work?
Well, we're almost 5 years old. And we grew out, actually, of another agency that was focusing on helping refugees. And in the process of doing that, we realized that it's not just a refugee that needs help with furniture and household items. So there are a lot of thrift stores available in the community, but there's another layer of low-income individuals and families who really don't even have the money to go to a thrift store to buy a bed, kitchen table, dresser, pots and pans. We do all the linens. We worked now with about 60 households every week.
Wow. We've been reading that the Oregon economy is in recovery, but what's your take on that? Are you seeing an increase in the need for your services?
Well, it's a little difficult in terms of volume, because when we first opened our doors 5 years ago, there were two or three other agencies that also assisted people with furniture and household items. They're gone. So really, in the Portland metro area, we're the only ones where an agency can come and ask for help from Oregon Community Warehouse, and not only can they get furniture, but they can get linens and they can get kitchen items. So when we opened 5 years ago, we were seeing maybe 10 or 15 households a week, and the beginning of this year we're at 60, and we hope by the end of the year to be able to see 80 households every week. And what's interesting too, we're seeing more and more people with mental health issues. A significant number of homeless people who have been homeless, and there are agencies like Join, like Transition Projects, that are helping people who have been homeless move into apartments. So we're ready to help with those individuals. But we also see a number of families that have been homeless, or families that just don't have the adequate furnishings. People, like in your last piece about heating, people, sometimes they've got to make a choice. Do they pay for food? Do they pay for heating? Or do they buy a bed? And their money is, there's such a struggle on making those kinds of decisions. And so oftentimes they don't buy pots and pans. They don't buy the kinds of furniture, or they end up with things that really aren't healthy or safe.
Surely some tough choices. Can you describe the typical household or individual who comes in for help from the warehouse?
Well, we do see a number of people with mental health issues. So elderly people, so people who are on very limited incomes. And so if something happens, they don't have the resources. We also work with women who are in domestic violence shelters, and then the shelter helps them to move into an apartment, and the shelter can help them get there, and possibly they get some state funding to get them started with the rent, but the agencies can't buy furniture for them.
All right. How can people listening right now contribute for your project? On the other hand, how can someone who needs help hook up with you?
Okay, well, what we need from the community are donations of essential furniture, and We, number one on our list, we need beds. We need the mattress and the box spring. That's the number one item that almost every family is asking for help with, a bed. And we're asking that the bed be clean, and relatively clean, and still have life left to it. We need dressers. We need kitchen tables, especially. We need tables that would be suitable for a single person or for two people, so the smaller types of tables, which is also a good project for groups who want to build something. We need all the linens, sheets, towels, pillows, blankets. We need things for the kitchen, glasses, dishes, pots and pans, cooking utensils. So all those kinds of things, if they're still in good shape, we don't, you know, you set, go into your linen closet and give us the towels that you're not using anymore. People don't come to us and ask for a matching set of towels. They're just coming and asking for a towel that is usable. For some reason, we have plenty of sofas. We have plenty of armchairs. It's been that way since I started in this. That seems to be the piece of furniture that everybody is trying to donate. And we do need some of those, but we never have enough dressers. We never have enough kitchen tables. We never have enough beds. If somebody needs help, the way Oregon Community Warehouse is organized, we respond when an agency calls us. So we actually, number one user is Multnomah County, either through their health department, their disability department, the Touchstone program. But there are, the schools can use us. There are really any nonprofit agency that is a social service agency that is doing case management can connect with us and have access to the warehouse.
Great. Thanks, Roz. That was Roz Babner of the Oregon Community Warehouse. Thank you.
Thank you.
Zane Kesey picked at the moss competing with swirls of brightly colored paint and patches of rust to cover the 1939 International Harvester school bus that his father, the late author Ken Kesey, rode cross-country with a refrigerator loaded with LSD-laced orange juice. "This comes off pretty easy," he said. "It's amazing some of the things that are coming out, things I remember." For some 15 years, the bus, dubbed Further, has rusted away in a swamp on the Kesey family's Willamette Valley farm, more memory than monument. That is where Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and hero of a generation that sought a new truth with the help of LSD, intended it to stay. But 4 years after his death, a Hollywood restaurateur has persuaded the family to resurrect the bus so it can help tell the story of Kesey, the acid test, the merry pranksters, and the psychedelic 1960s.
Portland has received $10.5 million in grants from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. That's up from $8 million from last year. But Portland's share was among the smallest of the nation's 50 largest urban centers. Grants falling under the Urban Area Security Initiative ranged from $207 million for New York to $5 million for Louisville, Kentucky.
To protect the marbled muralette, logging stopped across wide swaths of coastal old-growth forests in Oregon. But a new study indicates a small seabird may have been forced into decline, not just by logging, but also by overfishing. Fleets that hauled sardines from the West Coast may have forced the muralette to rely on poorer quality food, undermining their breeding, say scientists from the University of California at Berkeley. If correct, the theory may explain the dwindling of other populations of coastal birds, a point the researchers are now beginning to examine. Since 1992, the muralette has been designated a threatened species in Washington, California, and Oregon, mainly because of declines blamed on logging. The study does not minimize the effects of logging, but it does suggest an additional environmental threat.
Wildlife officials are studying eelgrass to learn about the health of areas where salmon dwell. Eelgrass provides habitat for tiny fish that salmon eat. Sediment in the water, often from farming or development, is the biggest threat to the plant. Little is known about eelgrass locations and densities in Snohomish County waters. To change that, the county has partnered with the Tualatin Tribes and the Northwest Straits Initiative. The groups are completing aerial surveys of the shoreline that show shallow eelgrass plant locations. Because eelgrass can live 20 feet below sea level, more mapping is needed. The county plans to do underwater eelgrass mapping in the spring or summer.
The current time is 5:19, and now on today's Earth Watch report, keeping an eye on the ice, as ice in the coldest parts of the world appears to be sensitive to small increases in the temperature of the atmosphere.
Some of the world's biggest pieces of ice are showing signs of change. I'm Richard Hoops for Earth Watch Radio. A lot of water is frozen into the ice that covers Greenland and Antarctica. If all that ice ever melted, it would drive up sea levels and flood coastal communities around the world. Scientists say that's not likely to happen soon, but some say the ice is extremely sensitive to the warming of the atmosphere, and we need to pay close attention to it. Richard Alley is a geologist and an expert in climate change at Pennsylvania State University. He says the warming of the atmosphere seems to be forcing major changes in some of the coldest places on Earth. One example involves a glacier in Greenland. It's moving toward the North Atlantic Ocean and away from the ice that covers the island. In just 5 years, the speed of this glacier has doubled. Another example involves an ice shelf on the coast of Antarctica. It covered more than 2,000 square miles of water, and it had been in place for hundreds and maybe thousands of years. During February of 2002, it disintegrated within just a few weeks. Ellie says we need to monitor changes such as these and explain why they occur.
We can hope that these changes on the edge of Greenland and Antarctica will go away and then they'll stop. But some of them could go all the way. And understanding at what point it stabilizes and at what point it runs away and falls apart, we're not very good at that yet.
Ellie says there are practical reasons to pay attention to the ice. If the ice that covers Greenland slipped into the ocean, it would raise sea levels around the world by 23 feet. That's about 3 feet higher than the worst flooding that hit New Orleans last August during Hurricane Katrina. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
San Francisco landlords are evicting tenants at a rate not seen since the dot-com boom to convert apartment buildings into more valuable condominiums. The evictions are primarily being made under the Ellis Act, a state law that allows property owners to evict tenants if they are leaving the rental business. Some worry that poor renters will be displaced, but others say the trend has helped create a new crop of homeowners.
A well-known Oregonian who served two terms in Congress and spent decades fighting for his beliefs has died from complications of Alzheimer's disease. Charles Porter was 86. In 2001, he wrote a resolution seeking to impeach the five Supreme Court justices who voted to stop the presidential ballot recount in Florida.
The current time is 5:22. Still to come on the KABU Evening News. Abramoff pleads guilty. Rhode Island approves medical cannabis. Hugo Chavez speaks of the axis of good. And you're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff pled guilty today to charges of conspiracy, fraud, and tax evasion. Ingrid Drake has more from Washington, D.C.
Charges against Abramoff include offering money, meals, and trips to public officials in exchange for favorable treatment for Abramoff's clients, as well as enlisting former congressional aides to illegally lobby their bosses within a one-year window of employment. Federal prosecutors also charge Abramoff and his business partner Michael Scanlon for defrauding Indian tribes of approximately $82 million in lobbying funds for gambling casinos. By pleading guilty, Abramoff will serve only 10 years in prison, avoiding a 30-year sentence. Abramoff has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors investigating U.S. lawmakers, including former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
As the White House slides deeper into controversies over its authorization of domestic spying, civil liberty advocates are calling for Congress to establish stricter oversight, and political analysts are predicting a shift in the balance of power between the executive and legislative branches of government. Anastasia Gnedyskia has more from the nation's capital.
The New York Times reported last month that the National Security Agency had been conducting warrantless surveillance since 2002. President Bush on Sunday described his program as necessary to win this war and to protect the American people. This provoked a reaction by Congress that called for a hearing to discuss in the new year the presidential powers in wartime. According to Michael Horowitz of Hudson Institute, this kind of initiative by Congress is only driven by immediate political gain.
The Democrats smell blood in the water. They think that there's a chance to retake Congress because the political stakes could not be higher. So I discount much of that as a rhetoric having to do with people looking to elections much more than I do think of it as reflecting fundamental disagreement within the United States over anti-terrorist policy.
Some congressmen state Bush had no legal right to authorize domestic wiretaps without obtaining a warrant from a court in accordance with Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. Judd Legum, the research director at the Center for American Progress.
I don't think it's a partisan issue. I think we've seen Democrats and Republicans who are upset at this. Arlen Specter is the one who's calling for hearings. He said it was clearly inappropriate. You've had Senator Hagel, Senator Snow. The issue was there was a whole process that we went through with the Patriot Act where we were working through these issues. What's the scope of executive power? What's the role of the FISA court? And what the Bush administration did and what they didn't tell most of the members of the Congress was they were going around that.
Legum agrees with those who predict a major shift in relationships between president and the Congress in the new year.
From now on, when the president requests additional power, additional authority, you're going to find Congress a lot more skeptical because the administration has shown they'll not only go up to the line of the power they'll give him, but well beyond it.
In the meantime, the Justice Department has opened an investigation of the unauthorized disclosure of classified information related to the National Security Agency. This was done after President Bush called the disclosure of the domestic spying program's existence a shameful act. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska in Washington, D.C.
The After Downing Street Coalition, an alliance of over 100 grassroots organizations, has launched a new website campaign called censurebush.org. The site is to support House Resolution 635, introduced by John Conyers, to censure Bush and Cheney, investigate the administration's crimes, and make recommendations for impeachment. Visitors to the site may sign on as citizen sponsors of the impeachment effort.
Lawyers for four U.S. Marines charged with raping a 22-year-old Filipino woman asked Tuesday that the case be dismissed or suspended. The case, seen as a test of a bilateral accord allowing American troops to train here, has stirred emotions in the former U.S. colony. The visiting forces agreement was negotiated after the 1992 closure of all permanent U.S. military bases in the Philippines. Prosecutors allege that Lance Corporal Daniel Smith raped the woman on November 1st inside a van at Subic Bay, a former U.S. naval base northwest of Manila, as fellow Marines cheered him to the beat of loud music. Smith claims he only had consensual sex. At the time of the alleged rape, the men were on leave after participating in joint exercises with Filipino forces.
Rhode Island on Tuesday became the 11th state to legalize medical marijuana and the first since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in June that patients who use the drug can still be prosecuted under federal law. The House overrode a veto by Governor Don Carcieri. The vote was 59-13 and allows people with illnesses such as cancer and AIDS to grow up to 12 marijuana plants or buy 2.5 ounces of marijuana to relieve their symptoms. Those who do are required to register with the state and get an identification card. Federal law prohibits any use of marijuana, but Maine, Vermont, Alaska, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington allow it to be grown and used for medicinal purposes. The U.S. High Court ruled June 6 that people who smoke marijuana because their doctors recommend it can still be prosecuted under federal drug laws, even if their states allow it. Federal authorities, however, have conceded that they are unlikely to prosecute many medicinal marijuana users. Representative Thomas Slater, who has cancer, told fellow lawmakers before the vote, "I'm sure everybody in this room knows at least one person who would have benefited from medical marijuana." Slater says he doesn't use marijuana now, but it could become part of his treatment in the future.
The current time is 5:29, and now Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W. is fond of philosophizing about his vision of an ownership society, organized not on a governmental model, but on the corporate structure. I wonder, is George even aware that the owners of corporate America have no real power over the autocratic elites who run corporations? The owners of corporations are the shareholders, those people who have bought the company's stock. But ownership in the corporate model buys you no democratic control. Take the board of directors, which is the official governing body of the corporation you own. As a shareholder, you get to vote for the board members, but the ballot gives you no choices. Only the candidates handpicked by the CEO are listed. Your only option is to vote for or against the corporate-dictated candidate. But, get this, even if you and 99.9% of the other shareholders get together and vote against the CEO's choice, the corporate candidate still wins, assuming the candidate is smart enough to vote for himself. And by the way, they're nearly always men. Under the self-rigged corporate rules, it takes only a single vote to elect the chosen candidate. As if this Soviet-style electoral system does not give corporate executives enough control over owners, CEOs are now taking extraordinary steps to assure that they get no interference from pesky shareholders. It seems that more and more of these shareholders/owners have been showing up at the annual board meeting to raise issues and even raise a ruckus about how the place is being run. So, to fend off even this minimal democratic intrusion, corporations have begun hiring surveillance firms to snoop on their own owners, targeting shareholders who might, quote, cause trouble. Of course, the corporate interpretation of trouble is to have anyone dissent from what the top executives are doing. This is Jim Hightower saying, on second thought, this sounds exactly like the kind of government Bush has in mind for us. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast, and then at 6 p.m. hear a special on community radio in Africa, and then a year in review and prison pipeline. At 7, it's Clemmie's Grooves. Tonight's weather, showers in the evening, and then a chance of showers after midnight. Patchy fog late, lows around 40. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy, with patchy fog in the morning, highs around 50 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Complaints are heating up over a disputed holy site in Jerusalem. A top Muslim cleric is calling on Israel to stop work on an archaeological project because he says it's endangering two mosques. They're on a hilltop known as to Jews as the Temple Mount. To Muslims, it places where Prophet Muhammad ascended into heaven and houses the Al-Aqsa and Dome of the Rock mosques. Israel has conducted archaeological digs near the compound since it captured the old city of Jerusalem in the 1967 Mideast War. The work infuriates Palestinians and the Islamic Trust that oversees the mosque complex. Violence erupted at the flashpoint after a 2000 visit to the site by Ariel Sharon, then the opposition leader. Unrest lasted 5 years, killing 3,500 Palestinians and 1,000 Israelis.
Today in Palestine, it's the first official day of campaigning for parliamentary elections set to take place on January 25th. But escalating conflicts between Israeli officials, the Palestinian leadership, and more militant factions may derail the vote.
The lot of the village may quickly become worse. The Israeli military is set this month to begin building a security fence that would further separate the village from the others nearby it. The villagers have appealed to an Israeli court, which found in favor of the military. Musa again.
If they will not at least give us a gate, we must buy an airplane.
In Tawani, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Israeli settlers threw eggs at soldiers and police, serving eviction notices in Hebron today. Israel's high court ordered the evacuation after the settlers were unable to prove ownership of the property in Hebron's downtown market they have been occupying since 2001. Meanwhile, an Israeli high court ruling on Sunday will permit the Israeli government to build the separation wall in the northern West Bank in a way that would annex illegal settlements. This as documents surface calling into question the legal bias of other Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Manar Jibrin reports.
The Israeli Daily Haaretz revealed today that illegal permits were issued retroactively to build a new settlement block on Palestinian-owned private lands in the West Bank village of Belayn near Ramallah. Abdullah Abu Rahma, member of the Land Defense Committee in the village, said that the land was illegally sold to Israeli land dealers through forced powers of attorney.
In the past few days, we have discovered that some Israeli companies have illegally bought some of the village's land through forged documents. Today, the Israeli Civil Administration admitted this fraud. Therefore, all the houses built in the Mudayin Elite settlement are illegal.
The Belayn villagers fear that government documents such as those published today by Haaretz are the tip of the iceberg of a plan to annex all the village's land by the year 2020. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Evo Morales, the president-elect of Bolivia, will travel to Venezuela this week with a week from a visit to Cuba. But he would have been happy to travel to the U.S., except that Washington did not invite him. The Bolivian leader has good relations with Fidel Castro in Cuba and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who are both critics of the Bush administration. However, Morales is not opposed to developing ties with the United States, according to spokesman Alex Contreras. Morales, who will also fly to Europe this week, would have gone to Washington as well if he had been asked. Contreras says his close ties with his Latin peers do not aim at an axis of evil, rather to an axis of good. He goes on to say that the president-elect is prepared to talk to U.S. officials as long as diplomatic conditions are different from what they have been before. But he also says that if that does not happen, relations with the United States can deteriorate badly.
Hundreds of tribes people in India have blocked a main road in Orissa state a day after police opened fire during protest over a planned steel mill. Vino K. Jose files this report.
Indigenous people of Kalinganaka of eastern Indian state of Orissa have been demanding compensation for their land. Their land was taken over by the government and given free to private steel companies. Yesterday, India's largest private steel company, Tata's, started construction on the site with police protection. Spontaneously, the local people resisted and disturbed the construction. Police responded with live ammunition and 12 of the protesting villagers died instantly. The deaths led large numbers of indigenous people to block the busy national highway today. The roadblock brought traffic to a complete halt and seriously affected the movement of iron ore from the mineral-rich district. Private steel companies have set up huge steel mills in mineral-rich states of eastern India, such as Orissa and Jharkhand. In the past, locals lost land and got displaced in huge numbers. Compensation and transfer of cultivable land elsewhere is the demand this time. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for FSRN.
Canada is debating how its legal system should deal with prostitution. Free Speech Radio News' Allison Benjamin interviewed a legal researcher, a woman's rights activist, and an advocate for prostitutes on how the state should protect the human rights of people sex workers.
The toppling of the Liberal minority government in late November ended Parliament's second subcommittee on sex work laws, but debate about the laws continues, although technically legal, criminal law prohibits most activities related to the sex trade. Sections 210 to 214 of the Criminal Code make it illegal to solicit or to live off the profits of prostitution. It is also illegal to run or to be found in a body house. Soon after Parliament's dissolution, the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network released a report calling for the removal of these laws from the Criminal Code. Glenn Bettering is a Toronto lawyer and the author of the report.
Well, as it stands, having sex for money is legal in Canada, but sex workers can't do their jobs legally or safely because of the outdated criminal laws that exist. The laws and the way that they're enforced push sex workers into situations that put their health and safety at risk and leave them open to stigma, discrimination, violence, and possible exposure to HIV. So in calling for decriminalization, we're calling for the return to sex workers or giving sex workers more control over their working conditions. And if sex workers have more control over their working conditions, they will be better able to protect themselves both from violent clients or predators, as well as to protect themselves from sexually transmitted infections like HIV.
The disappearances and murders of hundreds of sex trade workers in Canada sparked debate about changing the criminal code, debate which was partly responsible for the two parliamentary subcommittees. In Vancouver, a police task force is investigating the disappearance of 69 women and one transgender sex trade worker. A large proportion of Vancouver's missing are Indigenous women. Suzanne Jay works for the Vancouver Rape Relief Women's Shelter. She proposes alternatives to both decriminalization and to the status quo.
We propose guaranteed livable income in combination with a federal, provincial, municipal government commitment to women's equality, which would start with the core funding of women's equality groups, adequate legal aid so that women will have access to their legal rights. Very often, women who are impoverished are actually arrested for the poverty crimes of prostitution and shoplifting and other small kinds of frauds. And they become criminalized over the course of time because they have no legal protection. And we would actually have some legal protection if we had adequate legal aid.
Rape Relief, as well as the Native Women's Association of Canada, the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centers, and a coalition of Asian women in Vancouver, are among activists who oppose the full decriminalization of sex work. They argue that buyers, johns, and procurers should be prosecuted. Laurel Ronan, a member of Sex Professionals of Canada, wants to see that sex trade laws are decriminalized rather than legalized.
Decriminalization treats sex work as a legitimate and necessary business. And legalization treats sex work as a vice that needs to be contained and controlled. Essentially, the control is taken away from the so-called quote-unquote pimps and quote-unquote handlers, and it's put in the hands of the government and the body house owners and the clients, as opposed to decriminalization puts the control of the industry in the hands where it belongs, in the sex workers' hands. We're the ones doing the work, so we need control over our industry.
It is thought that last week's Supreme Court ruling, which legalizes consensual public and group sex in members-only sex clubs, will not affect prostitution laws in the criminal code. The future of Canada's Parliamentary Subcommittee on Solicitation Laws will depend largely on who forms the new government. A federal election has been called for January 23rd. For FSRN in Vancouver, I'm Allison Benjamin.
China has reportedly released a Chinese journalist. That word comes from a U.S.-based activist. The journalist, Zhang Weiping, has been in prison since 2000 on subversion charges after reporting on corruption. His reported release comes 1 year early. A supporter in San Francisco says, after speaking with the man's wife, that the reporter was released after the remainder of his sentence was commuted. He doesn't know the reason. The United States has appealed for China to free the writer, and China's president is preparing to visit the U.S. Beijing frequently releases prominent prisoners in connection with high-level official visits.
12 years ago on New Year's Day, an indigenous army in the Mexican state of Chiapas launched a rebellion that captured the world's imagination. The Zapatista National Liberation Army chose this year's anniversary to launch their other campaign, a plan to build a new left-wing popular movement in Mexico. Tim Russo and Luz Ruiz followed sub-commandante Marcos from his jungle stronghold to the city streets of San Cristobal de las Casas.
Deep in the Lacandon jungle village of La Garrucha, Subcomandante Marcos emerged in a Che Guevara-style scene riding the Sombra Luz Shadowlight motorcycle. The Zapatista spokesman Marcos, who is going by the name of Delegate Zero, donned a black helmet with easy land and a red star stamped onto it and rode accompanied by the Zapatista penguin, a small rebel hand that stands erect. Delegate Zero.
Vamos a empezar a caminar.
We will begin this journey to fulfill our word from the 6th Declaration of the Lacandon Jungle. I was chosen to go out first and see what the road ahead looks like, to see the dangers and to become familiar with the faces and words of those compañeros and compañeras who have different ways of being.
Marcos rode steadily by the 2,500 observers, Zapatistas, and journalists that had come to Garrucha to accompany Delegate Zero from rebel territory to San Cristobal to launch the EZLN's other campaign. Commander Kelly officially turned Subcomandante Marcos over to the other campaign during the rebel speeches in San Cristobal.
Porque aquí es donde inician nuestros pasos para visitar
Here we take our first steps to visit your towns and regions on behalf of those who could not attend our preparatory meetings. We will listen carefully to your word, and we will also invite women, teenagers, all housewives and all working women in our country called Mexico to become members of the Sixth and the Other campaign. Upon arriving to the highland city, San Cristóbal de las Casas, greeted by some 10,000 Zapatista support-based members, the rebels and rebel supporters march into the city center, once again taking over this colonial town to rewrite history. The Tojolabal indigenous commander Tacho made a call to the eager masses to join the other campaign in order to struggle for justice in a unified manner throughout Mexico.
The Zapatista National Liberation Army, in the name of youth, children, and elderly support bases, calls on all workers and farmers to organize and directly participate in the other campaign, so that together we fight for our rights as workers in the countryside and in the city.
Commanders Hortensia David and Cebedeo also spoke before Delegate Zero took to the microphone, first offering an explanation in Tzotzil to the Zapatista support base and insurgents, and then directing his words to everyone present and to all of Mexico.
La sexta declaración.
The Sixth Declaration intends to go and talk, listen, and make agreements with all those who run the machines, the ones who make the earth flourish, the ones who provide services and move products all over, and in the end are left with nothing.
Marcos once again reminded those present that the other campaign is about a different kind of politics, not party politics, and proceeded to define very clearly the composition of this new movement.
We are putting all that we have into the Sixth Declaration and the other campaign. Our life is the least of what we have. Our moral authority, our prestige, all that we have accomplished is invested in this initiative. The Sixth and the other campaign have established a very clear line to which we asked you to subscribe. Leftist and anti-capitalist, not the center or the mid-center, not the moderate right or the rational institutional left, but the left. A left where the heart is and where the future lies, that is, a new tomorrow.
Monday officially became the first day of Marcos' six-month 32-state tour throughout Mexico, where he will attend public and private meetings with popular organizations, farmers, workers, gay and lesbians, students, and marginalized groups throughout the country. San Cristóbal de las Casas was the site for the first of those meetings. Carmen Rodriguez was among the participants.
La otra campaña es el punto de partida para que en forma.
The other campaign is the point of departure, so that in a peaceful and organized way we can ensure that our rights will be respected. And this will be accomplished with the participation of everyone. The Bastilla that you pronounced in 94 has blossomed and will keep on flourishing as proof that reason has always been on your side, and thus will remain in the hearts and souls of those of us that have understood your just cause. It strengthens us and gives us identity as people and as Mexicans.
Presidential spokesman Rubén Aguilar greeted the Zapatista mobilization, stating, "We recognize that the Zapatista caravan is a political initiative that intends to share their vision and ideas," adding that Mexican law guarantees Marco safe passage on his journey. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz with Tim Russo in Chiapas, Mexico.
More than half the Sudanese migrants who were violently removed from a Cairo protest camp will be deported by ship to their homeland. Human rights organizations have roundly condemned last week's riot police operation, in which at least 27 people died. On Tuesday, the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees expressed surprise about the deportation order and demanded a clarification from Egyptian authorities. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said that 654 Sudanese would be sent home because, quote, they were either found to be illegal immigrants or refugees who had violated security conditions, unquote. Egyptian law bans sit-ins and demonstrations unless previously approved by the Interior Ministry.
Five civilians suspected of working for separatist rebels were killed when their grenades exploded before they could hurl them at troops, the military said Tuesday. Tamil Tiger rebels blamed the military for the attack. Monday's incident in northeastern Sri Lanka was the latest flare-up of violence that has raised fears the island nation could descend back into civil war that began in 1983. The rebels want a separate homeland for the 3.2 million ethnic Tamil minority, away from domination of the Sinhalese majority.
If you're in the mood for caviar, listen up. The United Nations has all but blocked caviar exports from countries producing the luxury food item. Before they can resume exports, the countries involved will have to prove they're not using up their stocks of sturgeon, the source of caviar. The UN agency says many sturgeon species are suffering serious population declines, and new quotas proposed by exporting countries may not fully reflect the stock reductions or make allowance for illegal fishing. Major caviar exporters include Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Iran. The UN agency remains hopeful that the exporting countries will supply the missing data, which may allow international trade to resume.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K.
With the help of a $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation, Idaho State University anthropologist Herbert Mashner will continue work begun 12 years ago to document how Aleuts modified their environment over time on Sunak Island off the Alaska Peninsula. Mashner says he knows of 7,000 years of data from village sites on Sunak Island.
Humans have been in this landscape since the ice retreated 16,000 years ago, which means that all of the dynamics or the natural behaviors of all these large sea mammals are probably a byproduct of human harvesting. And that humans, through their harvesting, have actually engineered the natural North Pacific ecosystem, and there is no natural North Pacific or even Southern Bering Sea without humans in it.
Mashner hopes to get information that will help Aleuts deal with contemporary problems, such as the fishing bans near stellar sea lion rookeries. In other news, most of the money Wisconsin will spend this year to attract tourists to the state will come directly from tribal casino fees. But at least one politician thinks casinos cost the state more money than they generate. Gil Halstead reports.
More than 90% of the $10.6 million budget for tourism marketing will come from casino revenues next year. And according to Tourism Department Secretary Jim Holprin, there's more where that came from.
Indian gaming is a growth industry in Wisconsin, particularly because the tribes are constantly and consistently making improvements to their gaming facilities and are attempting to add new facilities.
Those facilities include hotels and conference centers that attract both tourists and businesses. Oneida Tribal Vice Chairperson Kathy Hughes says the state's decision to plow casino revenues back into marketing the state's tourist attractions makes sense. She says it will benefit tourist industry statewide and generate more traffic to the casinos.
We have always encouraged the governor to focus on the use of gaming dollars in manners that will allow the revenues to come back to the counties where casinos are located.
But a state senator cites a 1996 study that calculated the social costs of gambling in Wisconsin at more than $300 million in lost wages, law enforcement, and social welfare costs. Mary Lazick says spending $9 million in gambling revenues to promote tourism doesn't make up for those costs.
I don't see casino gaming as any benefit to the state in any way, shape, or form. Now, the proponents will say something different and have all of their arguments, but the bottom line, the hard numbers, there is not a social benefit.
But tribal leaders cite other studies that show casinos have a net positive impact on the state, including 35,000 jobs that tribal gaming has created and hundreds of millions of dollars in casino fees over the next 25 years. Gil Halstead, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.
Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.